by Emily Dickinson. Nature is what we see. The hill, the afternoon, squirrel, eclipse, the bumblebee. Nay, nature is heaven. Nature is what we hear. The bobolink, the sea, thunder, the cricket. Nay, nature is harmony. Nature is what we know, yet have no art to say. So impotent our wisdom is to her simplicity.
Such a pleasure to be back here with you all. Love this community. And I wish you all the best in your search for a new home. In my teenage years, I discovered the 19th century Hindu Saint Ramakrishna, mainly through the writings of Aldous Huxley and Christopher Isherwood. They were deeply tangled up with a Hindu mission, the Vedanta Society. Isherwood, in particular, wrote a lot on the subject. And in one of his books, I read an account of how Ramakrishna prayed constantly for a vision of his goddess. In his case, Kali, the divine mother. He wanted to know her as she was. He wanted to see her with his own eyes. I personally understood this prayer. It was my own longing from some aching place in the pit of my being to know whether God was true, was real, or simply a projection of human fears and hopes into the sky. I was looking for some sort of simple verification. Was my mother's fundamentalist God with white robe, a flowing beard, and bolts of lightning in one hand? Or my father's flat-out denial of the existence of any deity right? I never got a response to that prayer, more or less, I admit, inclining me toward my father's view. But Ramakrishna's prayer was answered. One day, unbidden, she came to him. In some form of waking vision as he watched, she arose out of a river and walked toward him. As she walked, the goddess swelled out in pregnancy, gave birth, and then ate the child. Witnessing all this, he slipped into a fever of ecstasy. As a young man, really still basically a boy, I was shocked that this would be a turning point in this revered saint's life. And I had no idea what to make of Kali. It all seemed so awful. But I filed this story away somewhere in the recesses of my heart, never completely forgetting it. Then, some years later, after I'd left the Buddhist monastery where I'd been living, I went to rural Oregon to visit my brother. While there, I took a walk where I found myself at the edge of a genuine wilderness. I suspect something like the Bénouville Pines. It was wonderful, if also a bit eerie to a convinced city boy. I sat in the shade of a large flat rock beside a creek. All these years later, I can still taste the air from that day. I can smell the warmth and the vegetation, the way light played across everything. At the very same time, this place was deeply silent and abuzz with life. Then, in the midst of it all, I noticed there was a sunny spot on a good-sized rock in the middle of the creek. I watched as a large, fat toad hopped up, settled down, and sunned itself. All was right with the universe. What I didn't notice until just as it struck was the snake. My heart leapt into my throat. I was frozen to the spot as I witnessed it all happen. In a bloody moment, snake and frog fell behind the rock out of sight. A small blessing. Then, minutes later, the snake slithered up onto the rock in the same place, with a large swelling in its middle and lazed in that same sunny spot. And I recalled Kali and Ramakrishna and that horrific and now somehow to me personally deeply beautiful vision. In a moment where I surrendered analysis and just witnessed everything, joy, sorrow, calm, ecstasy played across my heart. It was a moment that held the entire cosmos, excluding nothing. I felt my heart grabbed like that snake grabbed the frog. And I realized while sitting there in the shade witnessing it all that I too was swallowed by the world itself. And I realized in some deep, visceral way, I was the world itself. I met Kali and she was me. No part of the great mess, frog, snake, the world, hurt or joy was alien to me. It was me. The intense moment passed, as all things do. I'd had some experiences of binding depth, some mysterious intimacy with the world. Living in a Zen Buddhist monastery puts one in the way of such things. And since, as well, the spiritual life I find is littered with such stories. So, what to make of it? What is religion, spirituality, really all about? What is the problem that religions are meant to address? And what is the goal to be won? I suggest the problem that births the heart of religions, all of them, is some common as dirt and totally human sense of separation, of isolation. And the goal of religions, all of them, is a quest for healing in that sense of separation, of that haunting and sad isolation. And the healing that is found is some profoundly personal experience of connection. The words to describe that sense of intimacy appear to be nearly endless. Now, despite my beginning this reflection by describing an ecstatic vision, what I will call here an experience of unitive insight, I'm actually a pretty this-worldly kind of person. And this is important, I find our sense of a problem of isolation and our urging towards some kind of healing are completely encountered within this physical and, for me, biological world. For us as mammals, more specifically, as a herding species of great ape, capable of profound affection for others, but also with an unfortunate penchant for violence, us. We are the very stuff that creates the problem, and we can heal it. There is no scientific consensus about the biological basis of this unitive insight, although some interesting hypotheses are emerging. One of my favorites suggests we have two ways of perceiving. The one is expressed as our ability to focus on things. Think of the parts of our consciousness that allows us to invent a hatchet. The other is our ability to generalize. Think of that aspect of our consciousness which allows us to walk in the woods, aware of the possibility of a saber-toothed tiger jumping out of the darkness. Something if you go up to Debenville Pines, you may experience.
Only in the Pleistocene.
Only in the Pleistocene, which I believe is around the corner from Debenville. Now, each of these ways of seeing, generalized and focused, seem associated with brainwave patterns. Their functioning can be traced in an MRI. One suggestion about that intuitive insight is that there can be an oscillation between these two patterns of our consciousness, specific and general, that might be associated with some meditation practices, but also seem to just appear in human minds spontaneously. The oscillation can become so rapid, a third perspective emerges. the universe, the unitive insight. Now, probably this is not the right physiological description, but the hypothesis is evocative. What I feel sure of is that awakening into a unitive experience, what is also called the mystical perspective, is expressed biologically within our human minds. Now, that said, this is important because there is almost certainly a biological explanation for how we experience this unitive insight. Doesn't mean it isn't real. It sure seems real. It certainly has real-world consequences. The experience has both a spiritual and an ethical facet. The spiritual, if you will, shifts our stance in this world, bringing with it, in most cases, a settlement of the heart into a kind of serenity, a kind of peace in the midst of chaos. The ethical can be summarized as the golden rule. It is how one acts when one sees that we are, in fact, intimately connected. Contemplating what might be the overarching experience of unity, I find pantheism a really good philosophical stance. The word pantheism was coined by an 18th century writer, John Toland, in an essay about the philosopher Baruch Spinoza, and brings together two Greek words meaning all and God. All and everything is the divine. What precisely this means seems to be up for grabs. Lots of different ways to nuance this insight of our profound, intuitive, intimate connections, some with very interesting bells and whistles attached. And beyond the time we have here, the kind of pantheism that has caught my heart within the context of finding that unitive insight, that mystical insight that transforms hearts and the direction of lives, is sometimes called naturalistic pantheism. In this view, there is simply one substance that makes up the world. There is no spiritual and material divide. And this is, in fact, the pantheism of Spinoza and Toland, and before them of the Greek Stoics, and I would suggest, like the authors of the Tao Te Ching and the Zhang Zui, the writer who told us of the man who dreamed he was a butterfly, or perhaps it was a butterfly dreaming he was a man. We see it in many forms of Buddhism, particularly Zen. Actually, it can be found in the mystical traditions of the world's faiths, running from Judaism to Christianity to Islam to Hinduism, especially, I would add, Vedanta, to the several varieties of Chinese religion, just to begin a list. This pantheistic perspective is also the baseline spiritual stance of many transcendentalists. Emerson and particularly Thoreau come to mind. Think of it as a naturalistic mysticism at the heart of religions, a naturalistic perennialism. We're also wading into dangerous waters here. The unitive experience tells us how intimately connected we all and the world are, and often it leads people to act on behalf of others. When this leads to charity, all is good. As the late Bishop Dom Helder Camara noted, "When I give food to the poor, they do call me a saint." But it sometimes leads to a further step yet. And when people like the good bishop then ask why people are poor, well, then that violates a cardinal aspect of normative organized religion supporting the status quo. A major aspect of religions has always been crowd control. So the mystics are at the edge of their traditions, always. And their teachings are often suppressed. And sometimes, if they're too noisy, they're dealt with, and often harshly. As I said, dangerous waters. And fair warning, the unitive experience definitely is not nice. It is something terrible and wondrous. It begins as a new way of seeing. It is the heart that sees the story of Ramakrishna and Kali as one's own, of that frog and snake as one's own. The poet and old Zen hand Gary Snyder sings another angle into this mystery that goes into the wound and comes out a mysterious healing. Eating the living germs of grasses, eating the ova of large birds and the fleshy sweetness packed around the sperm of swaying trees, the muscles of the flanks and thighs of soft-voiced cows, the bounce in the lamb's leap, the swish in the ox's tail, eating roots grown swole inside the soil, drawing on life of living clustered points of light spun out of space, hidden in the grape, eating each other's seed, eating each other, kissing the lover in the mouth of bread, lip to lip. Something terrible. Something beautiful. All of it bound up together. A communion. A feast. Kind of like a church potluck. The mystery that is our lives revealed in the breaking of bread. Thank you. Amen. So be it.
Thank you, Reverend Ford.